But to talk to people who have done walked the same path as you before, that's number one. Number two would be, if as a founder, you can show an investor that you are thinking about getting revenues in as quickly as possible without deviating too much from your core goal. The only secondary point I would like to mention is deep-tech founders need to be able to distill the story or story part of this in the public media.
That's Rohit of Transcelestial with some advice for aspiring deep-tech entrepreneurs. So now let's listen to Rohit tell us about Transcelestial's journey.
Hey, Rohit, thank you for taking our time to speak to us. Looking forward to our conversation.
Great to be here, guys.
So, just to start off, you're working on a very interesting company. If you could tell us a bit about how you decided to start Transcelestial and how did your background influence this?
The company started around 3 years ago. My background is a bit in electronics, electrical and computer science. Did most of my university and studies in Singapore. I worked on Singapore's first satellite, designing solid communications array for that. Worked on some robotics projects, self-driving car, solar car projects, etc. So it's a huge wide range of stuff. After, as all engineers usually end up doing, I joined banking. So did investment banking for 4 years, particularly looking at electronics effects in terms of how do you move clients' money by avoiding a lot of the movement in the FX market. And for that, you need to watch the market very closely. And again, all of that, underlying all of that is communications. Is that how can you get pricing signals from all the various exchanges around the world? So latency was very key. And I think during my time in RBS, where I used to work, Royal Bank of Scotland, I focused a lot on undersea cable connectivity, which surprisingly known to very few people, is the internet as we know it. So more than 95-96% of the world's data goes through these giant cables that sit at the bottom of the ocean. So yeah, that was a very interesting kind of revelation and introduction to how the world gets its internet and how our economy runs. So left banking, took a year off to wipe off the dust from some of those skills that I've lost working in a bank. And then, yeah, started Transcelestial.
Amazing. And if you could talk a bit about, you know, what you do, because it's not very easy to explain. Sure. You know, if you could share with us, you know, how you describe your business and what problem you're solving.
In short, what we are building is we are building a space laser network, which is used to transmit very high speed data across very long distances around the planet. And the core technology that we are building, which enables this, is wireless laser communication or wireless fiber optics, which is basically using light to transmit high capacity, high speed data over very long distance. To put it in like more human perspectives, we are building undersea cable network, but in space.
I think if you could talk about how it is different from, let's say, current wireless networks or fiber optics.
Yeah. Right about the time when I decided to start this, the idea was to look at the next 50 years of human civilization and see what are the big overarching themes which are going to cover us as a civilization. And space travel and long distance deep space exploration is one of those things. So if you look at like currently how we communicate to probes on Mars, we are looking at speeds which are worse than a 1990s dial-up connection. So it's like literally kilobits. So we said, look, what if we can use the same physical phenomenon through which stars send their starlight across vast distances, but encode data in that? What surprising thing that we found out was actually there's a nearly infinite capacity for photons to carry data modulated data within them. So that means actually you can send like a massive amount of data bursts through a relatively low capacity light wave. So when you take all of that, you start thinking, okay, what do we do? What are the big problems that our society is facing right now, right? Like 50 years in the future sounds amazing, and we definitely got to build towards that using this stuff. But how do you solve some of the big challenges in communication right now? And then you look at that, we started digging a bit more deeper. The fact is that there's two big things that we need to think about. One is that in the last 2 years, we have generated more data than all of human history combined. Even the next 10 years is going to be staggeringly massive in terms of data production and transmission. That's number one. Number two is actually more than 50% of the world is still unconnected right now. And when you say unconnected, there's various levels, obviously. Some folks have basic level SMS kind of connectivity in the remote regions, but then a lot of the suburban population is below the basic broadband connectivity. So we started looking at that and we said, look, what's the big challenge which is stopping us from doing that, right? When you try to analyze this whole situation from first principles, you see that at the core, it's actually a distribution problem. And what do I mean by that? So the whole world, as I, going back to my original work that I did at RBS, the whole world effectively right now, the internet as we know, is basically this set of giant pipes which sit at the bottom of the ocean. And using fiber optic cables, they carry data across various continents. So servers of Google or Facebook or some of these companies which are there, they're in the valley, they are directly connected to undersea cables, which then pipe that data across the whole world, right? So that's your first level of distribution, which gets data to big continents and big countries. The second layer of distribution is basically from these cables, when they come up to a continental shelf, most of the telcos and ISPs then draw very long distance intercity fiber cables, which then take that internet capacity or the internet capability and then plug it into cities. And these are known as the second tier of distribution. And then from there, they redistribute to tier two, tier three cities, towns, villages, etc. The third biggest challenge is last mile connectivity. So when these big cables come to like big cities or towns, how do you then spread that out to homes, businesses, cell towers, and basically plug that capacity back in? So you can see that it's a massive web, it's a massive tree of distribution, and there are bottlenecks at every stage. We have reached our current level of technology that we have on the wireless and wired fronts, whether that's fiber optics on the wired side or your 4G or the 5G on the wireless front, has reached a limit on how much data it can support, how much costing it has to roll out, and in general, the cost per bit that is needed to roll out to the next 50% of population.
Understood. How did you build your team? Because this is a very unique and specific problem that you're solving. Yeah. How did you pick your co-founder, and how did you guys gel, start brainstorming, and eventually convert it into a full-time business?
The whole thing started as part of this accelerator called Entrepreneur First. That's where I met my co-founder, Dinesh. So my co-founder, Dinesh, was a physicist with background in laser communication systems. So trying to make surfaces which can manipulate light and photons. And so we started talking about like, okay, how do we send data across like vast interstellar distances, right? So how do we use gravitational lensing and some of that effects to actually set up a high-speed broadband network in our Milky Way? These are the big ideas. And then we obviously, as I mentioned, we started talking to more and more people and realized, okay, how do we implement it sooner? And then when you are trying to do something like this, and you're trying to get off a very deep technology from ground up, one of the key things that you need to build is multi-specialty deep tech team. Obviously, between the founders, we had certain skill sets like my network background and his laser and microwave background. But then there are certain dark areas where we want to fill up. So we have built together a team which has specialties from all different kinds of fields. Half the team ranges from European Space Agency with space background. You get folks from defense who have worked on the cutting edge for control and optical systems, things like that. So I think almost all of our team is like global. Out of 16, we have like 13 to 14 different nationalities. So boundaries become blurred, specialties become blurred, and you get folks who are just driven by how do you crack that ultimate thing in your field. I think on an average, we spent like maybe 50 to 70 interviews before we hired one person. So that's the kind of filtering process we have had for the last 3 years.
You guys also thought about raising capital. What was the process there? How did you pitch this? Did investors even understand you are building? Yeah. Because it obviously is very different from what they would usually be. How did you pitch the company?
When you do basic research and you are trying to get a technology from a research paper to lab to industry to scale out manufacturing and all of that, you follow something called the TRL levels, technology readiness levels. And so getting something across TRL1 all the way to 10, which is like mass-produced manufacturing, scaled, fully integrated kind of systems, is extremely difficult and usually takes 5 to 10 year kind of timeline. And so there are very specialist investors who understand that process. So these are folks who have seen that happen or who have already, who have in their past life done it and have now made enough money to reinvest, but have that experience, right? And traditionally, a lot of that has been focused around Tel Aviv and Silicon Valley, right? So raising in, so when we started in Singapore, it was extremely difficult, but almost 60-70% of my time was basically whiteboarding investors and telling them like, oh, do you know how you can, how do you get internet on your cell phone? And believe me, like more than 80% would say, oh, like, isn't it beamed down from satellites and space? So a lot of the time, you have to, as a deep tech founder in this region, you have to go through the journey of educating the investor, not in terms of the technology, but in terms of how they should financially evaluate the outcomes of building your technology. I didn't know that, obviously, but it's a learning process that you have to go through. No one can teach you that. So once you kind of got the hang of it, then fundraising became a little bit easier. The idea was that we started getting folks, whether it's angels or early VCs, who really believe in what we did. And once you get the first few checks in, that becomes your social network effectively and pulls in the remaining capital.
Yeah, so I think it's a good time to transition a bit more into how does one go about building a deep tech company. With a traditional startup, you go about validating assumptions through asking users questions. So in your case, how did you go about validating assumptions? Because, you know, I mean, you don't really have users that you can ask.
Yeah. It's a little bit of a different journey for technology-led company. Number one was a lot of product development, a lot of what you want to do and what the market needs and stuff is in the future. And by that definition, you need to arrive at it from first principles. So till today, almost every single product decision that we do, every single technology that we make or a market we want to approach is driven through first principles in the sense, okay, what do we know and understand as the underlying principle for this market, right? Let's say for telecom, that principle is cost per bit. That means that as a telecom technology, if you are capable of transmitting massive amounts of data with a lowest total all-in cost, that means you will win out. And that's one of the reasons for the popularization of fiber optics, because it can carry such massive amounts of data at relatively lower cost than other wireless technologies and stuff, or copper in the older days, right? So technology and deep tech startups have to think first principles on what's the underlying assumption for their tech being adopted, often going against what the market currently looks like. But what happens is, like, if you're working towards the correct assumptions and the correct first principles, you will be able to see that turnaround in the market in the near term or in the future. And the same goes to SpaceX. Like, they knew that the underlying assumption for rockets is not how powerful your rocket is or et cetera, but what's the lowest cost per kilogram that you can achieve to getting things into orbit. Number two is in terms of, I think this one is a classic rule, which I think applies to all industries. This is just have shit tons of conversations with people in the industry. So I remember in the first 3 months of our deciding that, okay, you know what, this is what we are going to do. We had like back-to-back calls, meetings, coffees, emails, chat sessions, discussions, just piled into our calendar. We would go in without any presumptions and we would just be like, hey, look, these are our assumptions about the industry. Can you help verify them? And we would have, let's say, a list of 10 assumptions in a week. You're like, okay, which ones of these needs to be revised? And you repeat that process until the point like, okay, you know what? This is an idea which we can execute on. So that's basically what we did. We, in the beginning, we went and talked to anyone who would answer calls and emails from Facebook, or we could get our investors or colleagues to introduce us to like the Facebook connectivity team, the Google X team, the different telcos in Singapore, in the region, globally. So you name it. Like, it was just like, if we would hear that there was a talk happening somewhere, we would just like go and barge and just like completely hijack that talk to validate our assumptions. And after 3 months, we have so much data that we're like, okay, this is a great one to go ahead on. And obviously that process is being repeated in the last 3 years. We do it constantly with every single client meeting we have.
So maybe to give a bit more context on this, you can perhaps walk us through the project that you did with SK Telecom in South Korea and how you kind of demonstrated the technology.
When you are a small nobody startup, nobody wants to work with you, right? It's a huge chicken and egg problem, right? If you don't have credibility, good people won't work with you. If you are a young startup, especially in the B2B deep tech domain, you're looking for very impressive upfront clients who can actually give you credibility. So you don't have credibility, you do credibility by association. And we were quite aggressive about getting credibility by association early on, because that's the momentum that kind of kicks off everything. When you look at deep tech sales, there's this amazing framework by this guy called Jeffrey Moore. And he has a book called Crossing the Chasm, which is extremely focused on deep tech B2B sales. One of the framework things that's there is that there's a bell curve of all companies in your industry, split between innovators, early adopters, late majority, laggards, and folks who are just like, who's never going to try anything new. Now, and the area under the curve is basically the revenue potential from that particular industry. So the problem is that, like, if you take any bell curve, the biggest revenue potential comes from the late majority or the laggards kind of space. The people who are really resistant to change or actually need a bit of time and maturity in your technology to adopt. So when we started off, we were like, okay, how do we find our innovators? How do we find that telco or that some connectivity provider who just wants to innovate and beat the competition? And when we started looking around, at that point, we already had started working with Facebook's connectivity team, with the same guys who were trying to do like drones, which power internet in Africa, a great, great vision, which had like some shortcomings and obviously didn't carry on. But they started this thing called Telecom Infra Project to do exactly this, as to how can they bring very new technologies to telcos who are genuinely resistant to change. And as part of this, like, we were one of the first startups to join that. And so we were looking at like the different telcos. And so through Facebook, we got introduced to SK. We got introduced to the head of innovation, Jiyoung, who runs innovation and now 5G for SK. And we started talking to them and we said, look, we know that you guys are trying to launch a 5G network well ahead of anyone else in the world. In order to deploy 5G, it requires massive amounts of infrastructure investments. To give you an example, if you take a single 4G tower, it covers roughly 3 to 5 kilometers of radius. But in the 5G world, that same area is covered by at least 5 to 7 more 5G cell towers. So 5G is a much shorter distance technology. It at max can go up to like 500 meters. That's it. And so you can imagine, in order to deploy such kind of infrastructure, you need a lot more fiber optic cables connecting these cell towers and bringing data to these cell towers. So we went back to them and we said, look, we have come up with a tech which gives you the speed of fiber, but with the flexibility of deploying it wirelessly. So your cost actually reduces by 90%. And that was an amazing number for them to consider. And they're like, you know what? Love to test it. So we started working, we defined the project. Obviously, there were language barriers and stuff, but that got ironed out after a few drinking sessions. The biggest thing was we decided a project, we rolled it out, we ran it for 3 months. We set KPIs, very strict KPIs from the network and research teams. We crossed through all of that. And obviously, like, they were super happy. And then we've been continuing to work with them since then. But the key was to find our innovators. Because of that use case, because of that positive feedback from the innovator, since then, more and more telcos started approaching us saying, hey, can we actually talk to you about this? Are you guys going in mass production? What's happening? And we were like, oh shit, actually we need to, instead of just focusing on space, it seems like there is an early market which is demanding this technology on the ground. And maybe that can be a way for us to reach early revenues, which can then fuel our space streams.
So can you tell us a little bit about what the timeline for the adoption life cycle looks like, and maybe talk a bit more about what are some of the incentives that will pull in some of those later adopters and get them to look at this technology more seriously?
When you look at the different sections, right? Like, so there's obviously like different incentives for those guys to do it. Like, when you are super early on and you're talking to like innovators like SK and Deutsche Telekom and stuff, these guys don't really care about if there are like hanging wires from the device or there are things that break all the time and you have to restart processes and stuff on the spot to make things work, because they understand what early stage technology looks like. And all they are looking for is a way to escape the competition that come into this early adoption or innovator category are folks who have a long track of being ahead of the curve. So they would always like to maintain that image, or usually in a market where there's competition, the second or the third players, because they would always like to go against the incumbent. So that's the incentives kind of driving the early stage folks. And it's actually not the incentive usually of the company, but it's always like the incentives of that particular VP or like the particular CTO who is just joined and wants to prove that the kind of tech and the kind of thought that they're bringing into the company helps the company grow and would in turn help them grow, right? So that's a very close partnership that in the early stages you need to follow. Versus when you look at the later stages, they pay a lot more emphasis on, okay, I have a job and I don't want to lose my job. So what that then translates effectively to, do you have the right partners? Do we have the right technology? Do you have the right documentation? Is a rollout as smooth as possible? Do we have, if things screw up, can they turn around and blame us for that and not take the blame themselves? So those kind of things, like their customers are reliant on very steady, very high quality services. Can we deliver the same to them, right? So that becomes much more prominent as compared to like the early stages. And again, the cost becomes a lot more issue. So while some of the innovators and the early adopters usually would look away from the cost of adoption because their motives are different, the bigger chunk, the late majority of the laggards would look at cost as being one of the key items. Where we are right now is actually in the transition process. We have been working with innovators and early majority folks, and they serve as great case studies for the bigger telcos and bigger ISPs and the bigger government projects, et cetera, that we want to basically access. But then changing the company from this like nimble, small, smart company to something which can deliver consistently, accurately, as well as at a low cost to a wide variety of customers, that has a chasm in between. And so that's why hence the name Crossing the Chasm is like, if we can't transition between this and that, we will fall into a chasm and the company will die. And so that's understanding the incentives on both sides is very important. Right now we are in that phase where our technology is good and it has been tested, but we are making the transition from technology to products, that what kind of products we need in the market using this technology to actually cover at least 70 to 80% of a telco's use cases or a communication or an ISP's use cases. And that we then put into mass production and scale that out.
Hey guys, really sorry about my connectivity issues.
No worries, man. I think every time you break up, it kind of solidifies my reasoning to doing the startup. and the three of us are having such a time connecting to each other. I just imagine folks in tier two cities.
We could talk a bit more about, you know, how are incentive structures specifically in more frontier technology versus e-commerce or software businesses that are now more ubiquitous or mainstream.
Are you talking from the incentive structure for a VC or the incentive structure
for founders? Startups.
So there's two or three reasons why you would start a company, right? Like one would be like what you're effectively doing as a founder is that you're projecting a possible alternate reality in terms of how you want the world to be, how you want a behavior of folks to be, how you want economies to function, how you want things to work out, right? And so the small subset of that is deep tech and frontier tech. I have found this like very, correlation that actually founders or employees which actually join frontier tech companies very early on in their life, they have actually spent a lot of time looking at science fiction or fiction in general and reading a lot of that. And they're seeing technological societies and they can predict technological societies much better in terms of, okay, if X technology or X behavior were to be extrapolated in the future, how would things work out? As a founder then, your chances of starting a frontier tech company or a deep tech company means that often you would be in a very small percentage of people around the globe trying to attempt that technology. Your chances of success, that ratio massively goes up, right, as compared to anything else. And then starting a deep tech company in an ecosystem where there is even lower possibility of that happening actually skyrockets your chances of successes. So to give you an example, if you were to start, like, let's say a quantum computing company in the Valley or in Toronto, you would face a lot of problems there because there's already companies trying to do that, D-Wave and other folks. But let's say if you start something like that, like in Singapore, right? You get government support, you get recognized as the leader in the ecosystem. You get like primary access to like the top talent from anywhere because you'll probably be the most exciting thing that anyone will ever work for. And chances are for some of the more forward-thinking VCs and investors in the region, you will be the top priority of choice because inherently folks love to invest in companies which actually change long-term out. But as a founder, your incentives of starting a deep tech company basically checks all your boxes. It checks your box of having an impact on the future. It checks your boxes of having a higher odds of success. It checks your boxes of having to fight less for highly qualified people. It checks your boxes of having government support. It checks your boxes of being more, being less affected by ups and downs in the traditional economic cycles. That's probably the incentives that play for a founder to actually start something like this.
So cool, Rohit. Thank you so much for the very interesting conversation.
So there you have it. That was Rohit talking about his startup Transcelestial and how he built a deep tech company. What I found fascinating was how he built his company thinking about it in terms of first principles. Our guest for the MVP segment today is a good friend, Akshay, who's launching a fantasy stock picking game today. Now, games are obviously very different from deep tech companies, especially in terms of the timeline. It's a much shorter perspective. There is one way in which launching a game is similar to launching a deep tech company. In both cases, you can't go and ask potential users questions to validate assumptions. You sort of need to imagine or envision what your users want and build it and then get feedback from their users. So Akshay, can you tell us about your MVP? What are you trying to build?
A lot of people in India want to trade in the stock market, but are a little afraid of doing so because, you know, there's so much to lose. It's your savings, it's your hard-earned money. And it's kind of hard for people to also get started because they don't know anything about the market. There's like a million books about articles and stockbrokers and the best way to pick a stock and how to beat the market and all that jazz. What I want to do is educate people and get them interested to trade stocks and invest their money to actually make returns. So what I'm building as an MVP is a fantasy stock picking game where people can participate in these competitions that we have of varying lengths and pick a bunch of stocks, create a portfolio, and at the end, whoever wins the competition gets a bunch of goodies. Hopefully this will like drive them to understand how the stock market works, drive them to do some research maybe, and hopefully lower the barriers to entry for the whole stock trading game.
Cool. So Akshay, tell us how you came up with this idea.
It's funny. I used to work in finance and a friend of mine asked me recently about, he's kind of building up some savings and he really wanted to invest it. So he asked me and I had no answer to tell him. I didn't know how to tell him to learn. I did some research and I figured out that there's a lot of stuff on making stock trading easier by following other people's like portfolios and investing alongside people, but nothing that really teaches you how to trade in the market. So that's kind of where it began.
That's quite interesting. So can you tell us what are some of the assumptions that you have with this game? You touched on them a little bit, but if you can maybe talk about it in a bit more detail and explain to us what data you're planning to collect from the first few users.
So I think fundamentally, my biggest assumption is that there are a lot of people who want to trade stocks, but are either afraid or don't know how to get started. And they really want to learn to actually invest their money and not take their parents' recommendations for, hey, go buy this mutual fund or whatever. In terms of data, the biggest one for me is probably the return rate for the competitions. So like I said, we have a few competitions and I want to see if people who participate in week one actually end up coming for week two and if they bring friends to join in week two. Another thing that I want to collect as data is to see how often people update their entry of a competition because this could mean that they're learning about the stock market. They're kind of figuring out what stocks are better or someone's recommending them and they're trying by error. So those are two things that I want to see over the first couple of weeks.
That's awesome. And you're launching this game today, right? So people can try it out and give you feedback just by using the game.
Yeah, exactly. And it's pretty easy. All you have to do is just log in and, you know, kind of pick some stocks.
Where do you see this going? Let's say you do get a few people using it. Where do you see this game evolving?
I mean, it's hard to say right now. I could see it going a couple of ways. Maybe it becomes sort of like a learning tool which also has a stock trading element. So you kind of finish this course about, you know, learning the stock market and then invest some virtual currency and then move on to investing real currency with like a social element. So you have friends on a leaderboard and stuff like that. Or it could end up being like a brokerage firm where you follow portfolios of like high profile investors or people who are doing well, and you can kind of invest alongside with them. It's hard to say, but I could see it going a couple of ways.
All right, so guys, check it out. The website is stockquity.in. That's spelled S-T-O-Q-U-I-T-Y. And whether you're familiar with the stock market or not, check it out. You just have to log in and you can participate for free and win gift cards as prizes. And at the same time, you'll be helping Akshay out by giving him feedback. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon.